Good morning, Brendan.
What time are you recording at?
The Not a Thing podcast is up and recording for episode 183. It might be morning. It's morning somewhere, right?
Well, I don't know. What time zone are you recording in?
Well, it's Pacific, so it's not morning where I am.
Okay. I mean, yeah, that's fine. that's all fine then. I'm not confused at all.
It might be morning in China, however, which is where our first story comes from. We're going to talk about drones, but not really in a kind of drone context as we generally do. We're actually talking specifically about drone manufacturer DJI, which is the maker of the DJI Phantom, which seems to be the kind of, I don't know, the standard drone that you can buy. It's like it's something between $500 and $1,000, and it's white, the quadcopter. I feel like there's they already have the knockoffs being sold in the malls now, so it's ubiquitous enough. But interestingly, DJI, they've had kind of a big success pairing with GoPro recently and trying to really get their drones and the cameras out for kind of fancier footage and things. But the company released at a press conference or something today or recently that they're a Chinese company, and as such they're subject to a lot of Chinese laws. And one of the things that they announced that they do is that they cooperate with the Chinese government when they need to, you know, when they're asked to turn something over for evidentiary purposes or investigation or really whatever. And I think it was something like they had, I think it was 1,000 requests in the prior year. Interestingly, they just cooperate. They flat out cooperate with the government in China. Which is probably wise, because the Chinese government is can be a little rough on people.
Pushy? Is that? I think that might be putting it too lightly.
Right. But interestingly, this cooperation includes a lot more than you might think. As they are drones, they're remote controlled. They're remote controlled via an app. And that app can and does transmit telemetry data back to the servers at DJI. So if you are flying your drone using the app that it comes with, you're potentially giving all of that flight information to the Chinese government should they wish to look at it or do anything with it. And furthermore, any of the photos or videos that are taken with the onboard cameras can be stored in the cloud, which in this case is in China, and thus subject to the same protections or lack thereof in of the ability of the Chinese government to be able to see everything. This is kind of a big deal for privacy folks. I feel like it's something that we sort of knew all along, which is why we were kind of anti-drone, aside from all of the other kind of privacy annoying things about drones and their just general existence. This is the company of probably the most popular, if not the most well-known, set of quadcopter drones that are out there, admitting that it can cooperate with the Chinese government. The article goes on to say that not only is there the potential for monitoring of the drones in flight just by their telemetry data, they also say if they needed to, they could override those controls remotely, which is just, I mean, it's everyone's privacy nightmare just exploded into this drone. So you don't even need sleeper agents. They're already sold in the United States.
I have to talk to some sort of Chinese Lucius Fox.
Well, if we use it to kill the Joker, then maybe it's okay, I guess. I don't know. Probably not, though. Probably not, though, because then it would create what is it? A two-face, right? Isn't that how that worked?
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, we're gonna move from autonomous flying things to autonomous driving things. This time, it's a story about autonomous car track day. It's a workshop of sorts that's being put on for drivers, or actually anyone that's researching anything into self-driving cars. So there's a request on their website, which is selfracingcars.com, which I think is kind of funny, but it's all about any of the companies that want to test anything regarding the sensors, hardware for tracking other cars, remote controlled driving, autonomous driving, ranging and all the software that's involved and stuff like that. And they go further to say that they'll even supply hardware cars and drivers if you have things to test. And there's a list of companies that are helping sponsor. I think one of them is a company that Tesla has some stake in. So it's possible that the controls and stuff that are going into the Tesla autopilots are going to be out there for this. But it's the interesting thing is this is not like a real world driving kind of thing. This is made specifically for racing cars on a racetrack, which I think makes it less interesting to me, or even not interesting and not a thing.
Yeah, no, self-racing cars is not a thing.
I mean, I don't even watch when cars are raced by humans. So
yeah, no, that.
I feel like having the computers race them is not. That's. I don't understand the appeal, other than to say, oh, it happened, but
not... It's like bigger slot car racing. It's a waste of gasoline.
Well, and it's true, and it would be gasoline probably. I don't think it doesn't say anything about the cars being electrically powered or sustainably powered at all. This is purely racing cars. So if cars go the way of kind of autonomous driving and electricity, are the self-racing cars going to be gas still? Because that's the only way you'll have interesting variation of engines and stuff like that.
Probably. That seems very unenvironmental.
It does seem like a bad plan, but that's
just have it all simulated on a computer. If it's just going to be computers racing computers, what's the point? And yet, that's the peak of first world jackassery.
Right, simulating the completely automated driving cars. Not a thing.
I do appreciate it as an avenue for them to improve that technology for actual useful use. But yeah, if that becomes a competitive thing, that's just dumb.
Yeah, I know that Tesla was bragging earlier in the week around the number of miles that have been driven autonomously by their fleet of cars, and they say that essentially every time you take a Tesla out on the road that it's getting data for how cars behave, how road conditions are, how people drive, and how that can in theory be learned from for programming the cars kind of autonomously, which I think is a really smart way to do it, to have that kind of out in the field. It is a little creepy that all of that data is going to be centralized, but you know, as we've said before around self-driving cars, that's really the only way to get them so they work. The cars have to
practice,
talk to each other and figure that out. I yearn for the day when the light turns green and the entire line of cars steps on the gas at once. I would love just for more than five cars to make it through the intersection by my house. But I digress. We're going to stick with cars and move over to talk about cheating emissions, but not the Volkswagen cheating of emissions. This one is actually from Japan. This is Mitsubishi Motors has admitted that they have put out something on the order of 600,000 cars globally that are lying about their fuel efficiency. This is kind of noteworthy, not just because Volkswagen had a similar kind of round of cheating that they have admitted to, but this was specifically in the department of cars that were marketed as fuel efficient. And in a lot of the countries where they're selling these, and it looks like these are not cars that are sold in the US, but they're kind of larger trucks and some passenger cars. So, but they're listed under the heading of kind of high fuel efficiency cars, such that they get tax breaks in the countries that they're being sold in. So not only would you be, you know, screwed out of a car that gives you, you know, a tax break, it also is probably going to require some kind of, you know, retrofitting in order to work, and thus be even less fun to drive as a fuel efficient car. And this is, like I said, on the heels of the diesel scandal from Volkswagen and Volkswagen and Audi, and I guess Porsche also. I don't know if there's a Porsche branded diesel car. Maybe they're Cayenne, but in any case, that had a court hearing today, although nothing was officially announced other than they're going to announce it in June. It does sound like the judge is at least accepting of the steps Volkswagen's taking or going to take regarding the diesel cars on the road. But it's not, they haven't officially announced what they're going to do. The going rumor, which was supposedly leaked yesterday, is that Volkswagen's actually going to buy back all of the cars in the United States, which is something on the order of 500,000 cars, which is a lot of freaking cars. They've yet to say what's happening to those cars. The current kind of thought about that is they'll be sold in a place where the emissions matter less, which probably means they're going to ship them to Mexico and sell them there, which is really...
I mean, the emissions matter everywhere on Earth, so maybe they should just ship them to Mars.
Well, Mars already has like a lot of you know, too high of a CO2.
Yeah, serious greenhouse problem over there. Although, a little different, but yeah, still.
Yeah. It's not a good situation for Volkswagen, and it looks like it's going to be not a good situation for Mitsubishi as well. At least Mitsubishi, I think it's only 600,000 cars. I say only, like that's not a lot of cars. But it's not 11 million cars, which is what Volkswagen's problem was. I think, again, this really just points to what is happening. I thought the testing of these is done by a third party, And it must be that they're just cheating that third party. I thought maybe these were like self-reported kinds of measures, and no, these are deliberately cheating the tests and the measurements, which mean that the measuring standards also have to change, which may kind of open up more evidence of cheating in different companies. I just kind of suspect that that's gonna go that way. But it could just be, you know, there are a couple bad apples in this bunch, and they happen to be named Mitsubishi and Volkswagen. But but who knows? That kind of story is still developing. We talked a little bit about what it would take to kind of fix that when we were talking about the Jeep that could be remote controlled, and how they were Jeep and the owners of Jeep, whom I don't remember right now, were suppressing the media around that, and suppressing the leaks about how to hack into the Jeep to remote control its brakes or whatever. And they were claiming the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the DMCA. They were invoking that to say that no, if you hack or tinker with that, then that's what you're breaking the law with. There's kind of a push, kind of going along with that to open source the workings of those cars, especially with regards to controls and signaling and stuff like that, because it would, in theory, expose more of the problems before the cars were released out to the road. I'm not entirely sure if that's, you know, the best way to do it, but it certainly would have exposed what was going on cheating wise with Volkswagen. I read actually just yesterday that the internal probe that Volkswagen is running to figure out, you know, who knew and who didn't know about the cheating, the emissions cheating, they found evidence that there were code words used to talk about it, because they're not going to store all the files in, you know, emissions cheating folder one or whatever. Instead, the project in some circles was called acoustical software, and things like that. So there's been some creative hiding around that, and they've said that even the internal investigators they've hired are having trouble figuring out, you know, who's who, which they just have to, you know, they really have to put more pressure on the people in charge there, who have resigned, but they can still be kind of sued and compelled to give testimony about what's happening, because it's just a real bad situation. You're cheating everybody. You're cheating the consumer, you're cheating the dealer, and you're cheating the earth, which is really lame. Don't cheat the earth.
Don't cheat the earth. That's not a thing.
Kind of sticking in line with not cheating the earth is a company that was released a smartphone called Fairphone. And Fairphone is as close as they could make it to have an ethical smartphone. And what they mean by ethical is normally smartphones, the timeline for smartphones has gotten really short. I think it's the flagship phones from both Apple and Samsung, which are kind of the dominant big carriers, it's less than, I think it's 18 months now that they have their phones. It may even be as fast as yearly is the update speed for those phones. And those phones are, you know, not only are they expensive, you know, $600 and up for some of the phones, they are they're essentially dead when you can't use them anymore or when you don't use them anymore. You pretty much can't do anything with a phone that that you replace. You might be able to hand it in to them to recycle, but it still has to go through kind of a recycling and reclamation process, which probably is not built into the phone as it is. And so Fairphone, their whole deal is that the major components of the phone can be changed out, and it's the phone is built in such a way that it only requires like a small Phillips screwdriver to get into. So I think part of the reason that this works is that the phone technology has gotten small enough and the phones themselves have gotten big enough that people are okay with having kind of a bigger phone, like a 6 Plus or the Galaxy Note or whatever is those size of phones. But because those phones are bigger, the components, you don't need to use like tweezers to get in and out of. So they've built the phone such that a lot of the components are pressure fit together once you've screwed it all down, and they're discrete so that you can take parts out and replace them yourself without bringing them to an expensive repair store. And they do sell the replacement parts for things like the screen and the buttons and the guts of the phone, like the camera and the logic board and all of that kind of stuff. It's made to be taken apart and upgraded and put back together, which I think is interesting. It means they've built in the recyclability of the phone into the phone. And they've also, they claim that they've done their best to use conflict-free sources for the minerals in the phone, like the tungsten or the tin that goes into the circuit boards, or even their gold contacts in a lot of phones now, and those they're saying that they're sourcing them out of conflict regions. Conflict minerals are not a thing. I did a little reading around conflict resources, minerals. I'd heard of blood diamonds as a thing, but I didn't know that even just minerals were being sold by kind of illegal regimes in order to fund those regimes. So that's really really not a thing. I think I know there are policies around sourcing and things like that, and I know that a lot of companies are don't want that attachment, and I think it's good of Fairphone, this company, to pull it together. The downside that I see to this phone is it is a little expensive. It's I think $600 new without a contract, but in theory you could buy it with a contract and it'd be cheaper. The thing that is a bummer about the phone is that it runs an older version of Android. It's not running Marshmallow. It's running, I guess it's Lollipop, which is the older OS. And I feel like with something that is so made for tinkerers and open source, I'm surprised that it doesn't come with an OS that is more it doesn't come such that you can tinker your own OS onto it. I think if I were to run an Android phone, I would definitely run the software under that comes with Black Phone. Have you heard of that one?
I have not.
So Black Phone is it's done by the Silent Group, which is the kind of group of companies that was behind the what did they call it, the mail, the email that they
the end-to-end encryption one?
Yes, the end-to-end encryption mail. It had that really bad name that I've already forgotten.
That we talked about in episode, insert episode here.
Right. So the Silent OS comes with a bunch of privacy built-in features like end-to-end encryption for as many services as it can do. built-in VPN for the browser and in the software it comes with or it runs the apps in jails in the OS, so they can't break out and mess with your contacts or other apps or otherwise do bad things to the phone. It's an interesting OS. I will admit that I do use an Apple iPhone.
So when are you going to trade in your iPhone for your Tinker phone?
That may not be a thing. I do unfortunately like the ecosystem of Apple in my life. As generally paranoid as I am about privacy and security, it is a really nice phone to use. But maybe I'll look into it.
You get a new $600 burner phone.
Yeah, not bad. I think kind of sticking with the theme of upgradable hardware, Sony is coming out not with a phone. Does Sony even make phones anymore?
I don't think so. But if I don't know about it, it probably exists.
Yeah, maybe. Who knows? Sony is releasing, or they're working on a new version of the PS4. Internally, it's either being called the PS4K because it, in theory, can play 4K video, or it's known as the PS4 Neo, which is kind of a reference to the movie The Matrix, because I know that their VR project was called Morpheus. But in any case, they're refreshing the hardware of the PS4 and upgrading the processor and memory and a couple other kind of bits on the inside of the PS4. But in theory, it's going to be completely compatible with all existing PS4 games, and all future games that are branded PS4 are going to be compatible on the current PS4. So it's a really interesting bump that they're doing. My suspicion is that they're doing this because the PS4, the VR thing, Morpheus, whatever they're calling it, probably needs a higher processor to run the stuff that it does. And so my guess is this is heading that off by creating a slightly different hardware platform for that to work on. But I think it's and I know that they also are saying that any new games that come out have the option to be patched to run with the new hardware and in 4K supposedly, although I don't know how they're going to do that, because even like the highest end gaming rigs today kind of struggle with 4K video, which is, you know, four times the amount of pixels that come up. And as far as I know, they're only doubling it's not even double for the processor power. I think it's going from 1.6 gigahertz to 2.1, which I can't do math right now. That's not double.
Well, if you can't do math, then I'm screwed.
It's like 25%, maybe. So I'm not entirely sure of the abilities of this, and I don't think it's fully kind of understood yet either. But I think it's interesting because I think we've said this on the show before, the guts of a PS4 when you break it down is just it's a PC, and that's why they moved to the PS4 platform. The PS3 platform had this very specialized processor that was like this 8-core nonsense, but it was Sony proprietary, whereas the processors in the PS4 are not exactly off the shelf, but it's a lot more Intel compatible than everything else is. So in theory, You could just upgrade it like you would a PC. And I feel like this is Sony's kind of testing the waters to see if people would buy an upgradable PS4 or an upgradable hardware platform, essentially turning, going back to kind of the PC gamer roots of having multiple hardware standards, but maybe trying to lock them down into a couple different frames so they could control, you know, what's being sold and the quality. And I think that's going to be to compete with the still kind of forthcoming Steam box when that gets settled and put together, because I think the there are enough kind of hardcore gamers that want the want that library of games, but want the kind of benefits of a TV and playing on a big screen with a controller rather than playing at a computer. Have you ever?
Do you think we'll get the Steam box before we get Half-Life 3?
I think so. I think Half-Life 3 is a little ways off. Hashtag Half-Life 3 confirmed. But I do think that the things that Steam has done with, I think it's called Big Picture Mode, it looks pretty good. I mean, you can get to all of the Steam stuff with a controller pretty nicely. I've yet to run a Steam controller, and that's mostly because I'm cheap and don't want to buy a $50 controller for my Mac.
Come on.
But I'm interested to see how that plays with the interface. The thing that I had read for the Steam controller specifically was that they tested it on a number of games, and one of them was Civilization V, which I think is interesting that they would do that. I can't see how they would play that with a controller, but I could see it possible if they made it so that interface works with a kind of more standard controller interface. They can do a lot more with games as they go. So I think there's more possibility of a Steam-based box. But I still think that the hardware variation is just too wide to accommodate. So I think it's interesting that Sony is doing this kind of staged hardware refresh, because it probably will create a separation of the people that buy the new PS4 and the people that have the old PS4, and then there's the pressure to upgrade, and it'd be interesting to see how much there is of that. But I still think that having just kind of merging the kind of PC and the console gaming kind of spheres is starting to come together. And I think this is just one of the cracks on the way there.
Bring it all down.
Kind of moving away from the things and not things, but into stuff that are still things, but they're spoiler related things. We're going into spoiler land now with a movie that we both saw over the last weekend or so. It's the live action kind of refresh of The Jungle Book from Disney. When did you see it?
Opening night, Thursday.
Did you see it in like a large format theater or 3D or?
Nope, just plain old movie theater, local theater.
Nice. Yeah, I was able to see it. I was actually expecting that it would be in 3D IMAX, but I was reading a different theater's listings when I drove to the theater. I was pleasantly surprised that A, it wasn't in 3D nor IMAX, and B, that I wasn't going to have to wait like an hour for the showing. But in any case, I ended up at actually an AMC theater, kind of calling back to last week's story about AMC announcing that they would relax their texting rules, and then the day of our podcast said they weren't. So I'm pretty sure that was our doing. I'm going to take credit for it anyway. But I ended up seeing it in, I think it's called, they call it, what is it? Not Real D.
XD?
XD, yes. XD, which is the, it's essentially a bigger screen and a louder set of speakers, which was nice because I think the sound design on it was really great. the movie, I really liked it. I think I was a fan of the original cartoon, and I think they definitely kept aspects of it almost to a fault. I think that some of my wife describes Jungle Book as kind of, it's kind of fun and light and happy, and then there's kind of some 70s stuff that's weird. which so I think for the Jungle Book movie, they didn't keep a lot of the weird 70s stuff, aka all of the stuff with Ka. Although having Ka played by Scarlett Johansson, I'm not against it. I think the overall kind of feel, if I could sum it up feeling wise, I think the movie does a great job of hitting emotions a lot harder. I think the cartoon, like I was saying earlier, suffers from kind of a just, it's another goofy cartoon from Disney, and you feel that kind of as it's in it. This movie felt more serious, I guess. And even when it's silly, it still had that kind of background of, no, there's something gonna happen soon there, and it kept that. I think it was done well.
Yeah, I had low expectations, and I'd had reasonable expectations, they would have been surpassed. I really enjoyed it. It was a very important movie for me as a child, and yeah, it was funny. I laughed a lot more than I was expecting to. I felt emotion for the characters, and I was excited when there were fights. So, I mean, that's really all you want from a PG movie. It made me feel something.
Yeah, I think...
if it's not going to earn at least a PG-13, then it better make me feel something.
Right, well, it is a Disney movie, and if it were a... you know, if Pixar had anything to do with it, we would have been crying in the first like 10 minutes. So at least it didn't do that to me. it was really, really nice though. I think the look of it was really good. I mean, it's hard to tell what was what was practical and what was CG for a lot of the scenes. So it was, I don't know if, Disney's just getting better at that or the technology's just getting better, but I feel like especially because I saw it in kind of a larger screen theater, I expected to be able to kind of see more stuff and be taken out of the film by you know, oh well, that's an effect shot and things like that. But I actually didn't feel that way, and I think that's partially you know, because the tech has gotten better, but I think also stylistically the way they did a lot of the shots were, you feel more immersed in it, so you're less. It was harder for me to kind of step back and be nitpicky because they just infused so many of the scenes with things happening or story points or you know, good filmmaking.
Yeah, it was really well done, and yeah. It was. I really liked the voice cast.
Yeah.
They all were great. Mm-hmm. Ben Kingsley was great as Bagheera. Bill Murray was great Baloo. That just seems to fit. The Christopher Walken as King Louie was a bit of a curveball, but I really liked it.
I think it was an interesting change for King Louis. I like that they made him more kind of you know, he's pretty much, you know, the mafia boss. Which I think was an interesting push for that, rather than being, you know, just this kind of I'm the king and I do what I want. It's a lot stronger point of view for his character.
Also, Gary Shandling, the late great Gary Shandling, as the porcupine, it really brought me in right away. Like, it hooked me from the beginning. Like, okay, this is going to be fun.
Yeah, really nice touches. Not anything too... actually, other than the porcupine and the... Is it an echidna? Is that what that small plated animal, kind of like a...
I don't know.
Well, the main animals were not ones that you can easily make kind of dolls or figures of that look kind of like them, in the kind of Pixar vein where the 3D characters can be 3D models and toys immediately. So I actually like that about this movie. It makes merchandising a little harder, but it also means that you're not going to be flooded with toys and things like that from this movie. It's just a nice movie to watch. I think a lot of the character designs were really good. I mean, they clearly studied animals a lot to get the look right. I loved how Bagheera as the panther just kind of jumps onto things soundlessly. It's just so good. If you've ever seen, and unfortunately, the I think the big cats exhibits at the San Francisco Zoo are closed now, or at least closed such that you don't see them as much as the access that used to be around. But probably because A, it's sort of inhumane, and B, there was kind of a large incident where a tiger mauled a guy who was messing with the tiger, and you don't mess with tigers if there's anything you learn. But I just remember one of the things that was amazing was they were doing a feeding of the tigers, and the way the room was set up, there was a door at the bottom, and there's maybe like a 7-foot high kind of scaffolding, and that's where they open a small door and pushed out the box of meat. And I just remember seeing the tiger walk out of its main door, kind of sniff around for a second, and then jump up onto the scaffolding, which was maybe 2 feet wide, maybe not even that, like it was nothing, just like water, like it were water, except it was flowing uphill. It pops up onto the thing, knocks the food down and goes down to get it. And there was almost no sound other than everyone gasping at how effortless that was. I love watching kind of animals kind of move. And so I think it was really interesting to see that, because they probably had a lot of animal reference. I'm sure they didn't train a panther to jump up on things, or a bear to walk around and haul like things around. So it really well done movie from really just a lot of angles. It was a really nice movie to watch, and like you said, a PG movie. Like it takes a lot to get me to a PG movie.
Yeah, especially without the name Pixar at the beginning.
So I'm, you know, kudos to Disney. They're still kind of going strong. I haven't been looking for one, but I also haven't seen kind of a bad Disney film in a while. And I feel like there was a string of kind of mediocre ones for a while. So it's nice to have them firing on correct cylinders again.
Yeah. Good job, Jon Favreau. It's weird to think that the guy who made this Jungle Book movie for the whole family also did the movie Swingers. Very different films.
And Iron Man, for that matter.
Yeah, yes. He's done other movies. But that's where he started.
Oh, the 90s. Excellent. Well, I think that's kind of all of what we can do this week for things and not things. I forgot, or rather, I saved it to this part of the show. I just wanted to remind everyone to like us on Facebook and tweet us on Twitter and whatever you do on other social media systems, which we don't really have a presence. But
street corners, I think we should increase our street corner presence. Start shouting out the podcast URL.
notathingpodcast.com. If you would like to be a guest on the Not a Thing podcast, please let us know. We'd be happy to have you on the air. The only requirement is you have a thing that you'd like to talk about, and generally people have a thing or two that they want to talk about, so it's we're happy to work with you and set that up, and hopefully we'll see you soon. And Brendan, I will see you, or at least talk to you, next week.
Till next time, Alan.